Pythagorean concept of the soul. Tonight we wish to advance that a little further, developing from concept of the 47th proposition and its right angle triangle. We have already learned from this figure that the symbolic design is not equilateral, but is a triangle of one right angle and two acute angles, with one side estimated as a unit of three, the second as a unit of four, and the hypotenuse as a unit of five, and that these together constitute a most important number, for the sum of the square of these numbers is 50, and the sum of the square of the three and the four equals the sum of the square of the five. Now with this formula, which probably will soon disappear in our thinking, but should nevertheless be kept in the background as a key to the entire subject, we must proceed to the fact that the Pythagoreans held certain secrets and valuable keys to the mystery of the human soul. But these keys probably came from Asia, and certainly were taught by the Orphic, and later, after Pythagoras, passed to Plato and Socrates, and finally were rather beautifully systematized and summarized in the writings of Plutarch. Thus we begin with a field which has unusual vitality today because of our ever-increasing interest in psychology, which we have defined as the language of the soul. And from the Pythagoreans, we gather certain information which should be of interest to psychologists. And in most of the systems which have been developed in this field so far, there is a broad indication that these earlier sources have been neglected, and therefore that certain basic definitions, which not necessarily should be accepted, but which should certainly be considered, have not been given the weight or attention which they deserve. So we will proceed with certain aphorisms of the Pythagoreans concerning the nature and structure of the soul. First of all, the ancients recognized a triune nature in man, so that in the mysteries, the goddess Demeter is made to say, death makes two out of three. This is a peculiar statement, but indicates that at death, a part of the triad or trinity of the human personality is lost, or is cast aside, leaving two parts. Now, in our Western theology, we are inclined to think of these two parts as spirit and soul, but this was not the Pythagorean approach. Because actually, the Pythagoreans did not consider spirit as a part of the human personality. They regarded it as something far transcending the individual state of man. Therefore, that the personality with its three natures, or three parts, was suspended in a universality, which is life or spirit. But that man himself, apart from spirit, had three natures by which he functioned and manifested, and by which he was reduced from three to two by the phenomenon of death. Thus, to quote Plato, the soul is the most ancient of generations, and is the leader of all motions in the universe. Well, this is an interesting statement, and we must begin by examining this. As the leader of all things that are created, and as the most ancient of things, Plato meant to imply, by things, forms, natures, or bodies, having separate existences. Under this definition, the soul is the superior of things, being the highest kind of form, nature, or body, and that within this nature or body is resident the principle of motion, whether that motion be quantitative or qualitative. When that motion is applied to body, it becomes quantitative motion. When it is applied to understanding or to the higher faculties of the mind, it is called qualitative motion. Therefore, as Plato points out, motion may be a movement of the psychic nature, for the soul is a self-moving being, capable of moving that which is inferior to its own nature. By this same thinking, the Greeks affirmed the soul to be the mistress of the body and the direct source of the phenomena which manifest through the body. Plutarch, following in the ancient path, insisted that all things about the body which have qualitative or quantitative significance are due to the activity or motion of soul. Therefore, if we say a person is a fine person, we are applauding the motion of his soul. If we say that he's nasty, we are also criticizing the motion of his soul. For in all things by which he manifests, in pain or pleasure, in virtue or vice, in knowledge or ignorance, he is revealing qualitative soul motion. All motion of this kind being some kind of a movement within a field of qualities or a field of energy. The soul, according to the Greeks, therefore, was primarily and fundamentally a being. And because it is called a being, it is separate from and dependent upon being itself. A being is a creature or a creation, and all things that are created from a previous state and ultimately return to it again. And that which is the root of all creation is the uncreated state, which, however, possesses within itself the shadow and image of the world soul. Therefore, being moving into manifestation moves because of soul energy within itself. For things remain forever the same, whether in God or in the earth, unless they are changed by the soul. In this Pythagorean approach, therefore, we have the soul as mistress of body, and as the servant of that which is unembodied, that which is itself an eternal and real nature. The Greeks further affirmed that in the order of creation, those things which are superior were created first, and those things which were not superior were created afterwards. Therefore, those creations which are most primary and most similar in nature and substance to their cause are therefore superior and elevated. The soul, being the first of creations, is therefore most like the eternal. and possesses certain attributes of the eternal. These attributes, however, are diminished because in this procedure, numeration has already fallen into number, and the soul exists by virtue of number. Now, why do the Pythagoreans say that the soul has an existence only because of number? They answer that the essential principle of the soul is motion. Therefore, all motion becomes susceptible to number. Where there is no number, there can be no estimation of motion. All things that move numerically. They move in some way, and we try to estimate that way. If they move from one place to another, we measure distance. Or if they move from themselves, we measure velocity. All things that are moved, therefore, come under some form of mathematical estimation, because they must move in place, or in nature, or in condition. They must therefore also have environment. And so, being a thing can only be a thing because somewhere there is an absence of that thing. The only being that cannot be accompanied by the absence of itself is eternity in its own nature. Thus, to have motion, a thing must move. It must move in quantitative interval, which is called place or space. Or it must move in qualitative interval, that is, in condition, kind, or nature within itself. Motion being the primary attribute of the soul per se, or in its own natural and inevitable nature. It is said in the rites of the old mysteries that the soul is a wanderer, that it is forever upon a road, it is forever traveling. And as Plotinus tells us, the motion of this soul is wandering and staggering, as though it were intoxicated, or sick, or ill. It is interesting because, as we find out later, there is a reason for this erratic motion of the soul. The ancients, therefore, made up the triad of man with a body and two soul natures. There was a twofold soul. And this twofold soul represented the extensions of its own qualities. The soul, as the A being, was polarized, as all beings must be. Only that which is eternal being itself is without objectified polarization. The soul, then, has of itself two natures, and was termed by the Greeks either the rational or the irrational nature. Now, the soul, by the attainment of one of these polarities, becomes responsible for certain agitations or activities. A soul is said to be rational if, by its own nature, it verges toward a superior state. It is said to be irrational if, by its nature, it verges toward an inferior state. Thus, the soul, united with the mind or the intellect, is commonly referred to as the root of understanding, and the soul, united with the body, is referred to as the root of passion. Now, the terms understanding and passion are not necessarily to be immediately differentiated as good or bad. Understanding may cover a very wide gamut and is itself polarized into both good and bad. Passion also has a wide gamut and is polarized into good or evil. For example, joy is a passion of the soul and not necessarily to be regarded as evil. And the feeling of the plotter is a kind of understanding. It is a negative pole of the union of the soul and the mind. The difference of these polarities, therefore, lies essentially in the energies used by the soul. When the soul uses what is called intellective energy, its polarities develop on the plane of thought or of ratiocination of some kind. When the soul is united with the body, its energies move on the level of emotion. Therefore, we have a new set of polarities, thought and emotion, which we recognize very commonly in psychology. Yet at the present time, many schools of psychological thinking do not differentiate between mental and emotional soul attributes. They consider them as both arising from a common source. And they consider that thought, perhaps, is moved by emotion, or emotion by thought. They do not recognize, as the ancients did, the two complete machineries or chemistries are involved in these polarities. Thus, we may say that the natural tendency of the soul in seeking wisdom or in seeking improvement is to ally itself with understanding and bestow motion upon understanding. So understanding in motion is called the rational soul. When the soul verges towards body and motivates body, this motivation is called the irrational soul or the passional power of man. For passion is body moved by soul. And the two polarities become rather clearly understandable as we go further. Now, the body, according to the ancients, being corruptible of its own nature, must ultimately be restored to the elements from which it came, which are the earth. The soul, though having a greater and more intense life, was held by the Pythagoreans to have a certain corruptibility. A corruptibility, however, which is to be measured perhaps more in the terms of Buddhist metaphysics, where in the Nirvana we have the extinction of individuality, which corresponds at least to a degree with the death of the soul, or the death of the independent principle of volition or motion in the compound of man's nature. Thus, by the sage who becomes immovable, there is a certain transference of motion. And by the physical exhaustions of life, there is another transference of motion or energy. The soul, by its own nature then, according to the Greeks, ultimately was dissolved into the substance from which it came. And the ancients affirmed that this substance was called the lunar essence, and that as bodies disintegrate into the earth, the soul disintegrates into the lunar field. That was their concept of it. And therefore, we have reason to understand or study some of the ancient theories concerning the psychic nature of the moon and the even now recognized effects of lunar activity upon the psychic life of man and nature. Now, the ancients affirmed that the soul in man becomes thus polarized as rational and irrational. But in other creatures, which are not human, soul as motion or energy bestows a number of attributes. In the plant kingdom, the Greeks recognize what is called the vegetative soul. And the vegetative soul has one primary motion, which is growth. And therefore, all plants and things grow and unfold. In the the animal world, the ancients recognized also a soul power, which they called the generative soul. For the peculiar power of animal life to them was the multiplication of species and the projection and extension of forms of life. Therefore, Pythagoras declared the eighth part of the soul to be the power of generation. In the human life of man, the soul also plays a series of compound roles. For the mineral soul, which is the principle at the base of the inorganic structures of nature, operates through certain chemical fields within the human body, resulting in the structure and development of bones and other mineral parts of man. The vegetative soul controls growth, and in the case of both nature and man, controls another important psychic field, namely color. And we have the tremendous diversity of color, which is also a form of the soul energy. Lord Bacon writes an essay on the colors of good and evil, and this is a well-taken point. For that which on one level may be color, may on another level be vice or virtue. After all, these energies are working through fields appropriate to their own natures. In the animal world also, we find that the soul has moved from the principle of growth to the principle of independent motion. Therefore, we have the motive soul in man likewise, by which the body is able to move and to fulfill the various phases of activity, such as those trades and crafts requiring the skillful use of the body, or in the case of the athlete, in the training and disciplining of the body. The soul, then, has all of these attributes, and the Egyptians likewise recognized that motion and emotion have a common root in man's psychic life. The soul of its own nature being pure motion, if it moves in an unformed field, this motion is infinite. But the moment the field is limited, this motion is directionalized or caused to proceed in some direction, following one of the mathematical formulas of crystallization. So in the Greek thinking, and in the Pythagorean thinking particularly, and this also follows very far in the Socratic dialogue, the individual is regarded at this stage of his growth as coming into the world with a soul which by its nature and propensity may have three kinds of life simultaneously. It may have its own life, which is pure motion. And on a plane above body, as we know it, this motion, though not absolutely infinite, is vastly greater than anything we can comprehend. This soul, however, immersed in body, intoxicated by body, having taken of the drink of the waters of Lethe, or the waters of forgetfulness, and having become filled with the toxin of body, is then said to wander erratically, not only about the world, but about the body, causing a variety of stimuli, some of which are reasonable and some unreasonable. Also, the soul in this state of torpor, this state of involvement, is said to have entered into a sea of humidity, which explains the Greek statement that a dry soul is wise. This thought is a little difficult for us to explain immediately, but the Greeks declared that the physical earth was surrounded by a kind of field of etheric humidity. That this humidity was like a strange quicksand, and anything that fell into this sphere of humidity inevitably moved on downward into generation and birth. Therefore, the soul which was once dampened by the humidity of generation was required to be born. So Heraclitus observed that if the soul was wise enough to keep dry, it would not have to be born. This may have some consolation to the prohibitionist. In any event, the soul, having descended into generation, becomes, as it were, a principle of motion or energy within the body. It therefore extends outward through the body, producing innumerable manifestations. We find what we term evolution to be merely the ideation of the soul's energy. It is a constant motion, qualitative or quantitative. The process from birth to old age is motion. The problem of hunger and the digestion of food are motion. Everything, including the beating of the heart, is motion. And this motion is made possible because of the vitality of the soul. It's because of its residence in proximity to the body makes possible the animation of form. If the soul is thus immersed within the body, held there in this torpor, or caught in this curious quicksand of generation, this primordial ilus, or slime, which of course is the root of the word ilium, and which in turn is the story of the Trojan War, all of these mysteries of the Greeks have to do then with the two procedures. One is the involvement of the soul in generation, and the other is the release of the soul from the principle of generation. That which is the descent is normally called generation, and in the case of man, the ascent is called regeneration, which implies not only a return to a superior condition, but the attainment of a superior state or qualitative motion. Therefore, in the ancient line of thinking, the fall of man was considered to be one kind of motion, and the regeneration of man another kind of motion. Man being born into this world at some stage of his great cycle of activity is therefore endowed with a soul, by means of which certain motions and emotions are possible to him. One of the most primary of the essential motions of the soul is its pendulum-like swing between extremes. And these extremes represent either the rationalization of man or his gradual descent into a more animalistic or bestial state. In the positive motion of the soul, we have involved a principle which the Greeks call the principle of pure intellect. And the principle of pure intellect, in its completeness and in its essential nature, was considered almost, if not entirely, synonymous with being itself, because being was absolute intellect. But on the level of human power, human ability, the most positive achievement within man is the polarization of intellect. Now, this means quite a little a different thing from what we commonly think of as, for instance, union with divine mind or something of that nature. To the Greek, the intellect was something which was partly, at least, dependent upon the soul and the body. Now, the Greeks did not consider intellect in the sense that we might use this term in a depreciating way to represent merely mental agility. A concept of intellectualism is not implied. Brother by intellect is here understood a statement of the apperception of the workings of the universal mind itself. Man, therefore, has within him a potential, a seed of capacity to think with theory, to think with God, to think the thought of God. But this potential lies dormant in him because it must be energized. And the only way in which it can be energized is through the power of the soul, because the soul wakes it up, gives it power, gives it purpose, and variously, as Plato says, agitates it. If it is not so agitated, it remains only seminal or seed-like. The same is essentially true of body, because body is a seed likewise, this seed existing in a condition which we call matter. If the soul verges toward the body, it energizes the seed of body, producing what we may term the growth of bodies or forms. Of these forms, there are two kinds, one being termed rational forms and the other irrational forms. Rational forms are those which have within themselves, when developed, certain powers of knowing. Irrational forms are those which, when developed, become bodies but are not of themselves rational. And the human body is regarded as an irrational form because while it may have and does have kinds of mind within itself, and each of its cells contains an intellectual seminal unit, the body as a totality, when perfected and mature, is still not self-governing. The body of itself is a shell, a wandering thing, and without being ensouled, it is mindless, or soulless, or beingless. It is a moronic thing. It is a mongoloid type of thing, something that has no purpose. As we observe when, for any reason, the mind is diseased or destroyed, with it, it departs the grandeur or the nobility which crowns and makes important the fact of the body itself. So the soul, by the processes of generation, has been required and as part of its natural function. It energizes body, strengthens it, matures it, develops it, and brings it to its various faculties and dimensions, giving it also within itself a sensitive field, a field of neuronic energy, or the power of the nervous system. And this field, and this wonderful tutoring and care by the soul, causes the body to achieve a state of utility, a state of value, a condition in which this body has not only its outer form, but a series of inner incentives. To achieve this purpose, soul unites itself with the principle of body, in so doing, voluntarily sacrificing its own nature. In this union with body, therefore, it becomes immersed or absorbed in body, and is released again through the growth of body. Thus, what we call growth is always not an expenditure of energy, but a release of energy. And things, by growing, do not become weaker, but become stronger. And where growth is normal, nothing is exhausted by growth itself. That which is called the termination of growth is brought about by a transition in the psychic polarity of the soul. For when the soul has brought or led, as it is said, the body to a certain state, then the soul, having fulfilled its proper function, turns its attention to other things, and therefore ceases to increase the size or power of the body. Thus, at maturity, it does not mean that the principle of growth is exhausted, but that the polarity of growth is changed, so that from maturity on, growth moves by a qualitative motion within the body, causing a growth of character, a growth of understanding, a growth of beauty, whereas previously it was concerned primarily with the enlargement or strengthening of the body. The soul normally then reaches its fulfillment through bodily tasks at what we call maturity or majority. At that time, theoretically, the soul has built a body suitable to itself. If the soul remains associated with the bodily principle beyond this time, that which is its palace slowly becomes its tomb. That which it has created becomes its prison, unless the soul is able to achieve a proper transition from a material to a metaphysical polarization. Now, in the growth, then, of the soul itself through the development of the body, the Pythagoreans observed the various powers that are manifested through man at various stages of his growth. By birth, one power of the soul is revealed, and this power of the soul carries through the integration of body. At the so-called seventh year, the soul passes into its vegetative power, and the body increases rapidly in size following the principle of growth. At the 14th year, the soul enters into its animal state, intensifying the emotional life of the individual and increasing fertility and the power to reproduce its species. At the majority, the soul is said to be joined to the mind, and by so doing to cause the rise of the intellective nature. Now, this is a beautiful little pattern, only it doesn't always happen. And there are individuals whose souls, because of the destiny, or Plato says the whole world moves upon the spindle of Nemesis, destiny doesn't always permit, or does not, by organic quality, release the soul at proper time and under proper conditions. And the Greeks affirmed that this release has to be accomplished many times, and the probability of the individual attaining it in any one life determines on the practice. It is determined by the practice he has already had in previous lives. If it is the habit of the soul to be released at majority, it will be. If this is the first time it is trying to be, it may have quite a little difficulty making it. But in any event, the soul, by nature, therefore, devotes a certain time, a certain part of its own nature, to the perfection of body. And in this work, it builds body according to formula. And body, prior to a development of the internal rationality, was by the ancients not regarded as a self-responsible agent. And all creatures in which there is no conscious union between the soul and the mind are not held to be responsible for conduct. Therefore, small children were not so held, because they lacked what we term maturity. The soul, passing into its natural development, therefore, then goes on to follow through another cycle of 28 years, which constitutes its birth, growth, adolescence, and maturity on a mental level, so that the complete development of the being is supposed to require twice 28 years. By the time of this double cycle, the soul is said to have not only ensouled the body, but to have ensouled the mind, or the power of reason, and to have brought the nature to understanding. Therefore, 21 is the age of voting, and twice 28 is considered the full development of the body, and twice that is the age of psychic majority. The 21, of course, is the beginning of the mental cycle, which lasts for 7 years and terminates at 28. But twice this is supposed to be the birth of understanding, or the second maturing of the individual. In this concept, of course, we then affirm or assume that having completed its processes with the outer nature, the soul then takes over the generation of the inner life. This generation is the positive pole. The soul is now verging toward understanding. Under normal conditions, assuming that there were no pressures, no unreasonable obstacles presented of an artificial nature, the Greeks were of the opinion that the soul, properly and normally permitted to function, would in twice 28 years bring the individual to a balanced condition of internal and external living. Opposed to this process, however, we have the incidental or accidental circumstances of life. We have systems of culture. We have industrial concepts. We have numerous and countless restrictions placed upon the normal growth of the soul. Now, whence come these restrictions? Why do we have them? Well, they in themselves are motions, whether they are releasing or binding motions. And no institution or no system or no thought, no religion, nor philosophy can exist in the world without existing by virtue of the soul. Thus, the Greeks were of the opinion that when the soul, having achieved a certain majority, is then not released, is not tutored and aided, is not supported, it may then not make this transition from one state of growth to another, and instead of moving upward, moves again downward, and uniting itself with a now highly organized body, produces a series of manifestations which we term materialism. Materialism being the energies of the soul held in bondage to objectivity, not permitted to continue in their normal process of internal improvement. It was for this purpose and to meet this need that what we call today education came into existence. Education was originally reserved to the temple. It was that part of man's life which was devoted to the conscious program of growing up as a person rather than as a body. The body grew up and usually requires a certain amount of assistance in this procedure. In this process, the child is assisted parentally. He is also given certain social opportunities. He is cared for, he is guarded, he is fed, he is clothed. And he is encouraged to achieve that kind of education which will adjust him for a physical existence. Therefore, he reaches majority with certain skills or aptitudes suitable to maintain his livelihood. But when it comes to the second great cycle of years, the second period of 28 years, not only is the child without parental guidance, but usually is without guidance from itself. Furthermore, in the world as we know it, no opportunity of a suitable nature, sufficiently attractive to the soul, are offered, by means of which the individual can recognize and should recognize his life after his 28th year as a new cycle of self-growth. He assumes that by the time he has worked his way through the university and perhaps gotten his master's and his doctorate, he's had education enough. He has, as far as that part of his nature which is the compound of soul and body. Compound of soul and body, he has, by the time he finishes the university, as he knows it, achieved a full measure of education. But the ancients pointed out what we are beginning to learn, namely, that this young person can leave the university and 5 years later be a hopeless neurotic. In other words, he may also become a delinquent. He may become a criminal. And perhaps being more fortunate than this, he may simply be miserable for the next 50 years. He may not have any serious symptoms, but neither does he show any serious symptoms of improvement. He just goes along living haphazardly, feeling that he is schooled, he's educated, and therefore that it is up to him now to build his life. He does this without understanding, without wisdom, without direction, and without adequate incentive to these things, this being the most important factor of all. The Pythagoreans recommended two ways in which the soul could be released from bondage, a perpetual bondage, to body. And the state of bondage of this kind is somewhat parallel with our concept of the perpetual adolescent, the individual who grows old but never grows up, a situation that is very frequent and sometimes causes us to wonder how human beings do as well as they do and last as long as they seem to last. The Pythagoreans advocated what they called the discipline of silence as being very useful to the maturing of the soul. Now, silence was a discipline with them in which they imposed 5 years without speech. And, strangely enough, it is reported there were about 60 women who achieved discipleship on this basis. A rather unusual and highly commendable state of affairs. The discipline of silence was largely to deprive the individual of a large number of hypnotic circumstances which held him to materiality. Not the least of these hypnotic circumstances being the utter fascination of his own voice. When an individual says something, what he says goes around and goes in his ears again, and it receives strange authority in passing. By the time he hears it, he almost believes it. And if he says it 3 or 4 times, he is certain of it. It sounds perhaps facetious, but it is nevertheless true that we have talked ourselves into more things than we will ever realize. The second point in connection with the discipline of silence was that it was not limited to vocal activity. It was a symbol of the attainment of internal quietude or relaxation within the psychic field of the body. The purpose of this relaxation was to give the soul an opportunity to assert its own motives, recognizing that by quieting the pressures by which the soul is bound to body, the soul could restore its own equilibrium. Thus, by reducing the tension of living, reducing the tension of emotion and thought, and thereby not constantly focusing the psychic nature upon the body, it could be assisted to develop a greater and more independent nature. Now, the soul, as we say, is not only a motion, as we know it, but a constant focalizing of motion. A good example on a very simple level of what we are talking about is the individual who discovers that he has a peculiar pain somewhere. The moment he focuses his attention upon that pain, it will increase, because he will gather psychic energy and create an intensification of the pattern. A singer becoming throat conscious will almost immediately develop a dry throat and be unable to sing well. Wherever we focus attention, we create tension. And where our entire life is focused objectively, we create a tremendous objective tension. We focus every resource that we have on whatever we are doing. If our one great dream in life is to be the head of a large business, we will focus every bit of attention upon this. And gradually, we bind the psychic energy and make a slave of it. In other words, we take the soul, which is a being superior to body, and we chain it in servitude to body, making it a slave of objectivity alone. If we are successful in one pointing this psychic energy until it becomes a tremendously intensive force, we are termed especially successful. Because when we do that, then nothing can stop us. And we are going to succeed because we have determined to succeed. So we gradually develop into outstanding successful failures. Our digestion goes, our friends leave us, our relatives can't live with us, but we are a success. So we have ulcers, and we have nervous breakdowns, and we go to a premature end, because we have been so wonderfully successful in being unnatural, being abnormal, or perhaps more correctly, if not quite so flatteringly, subnormal. For as long as the soul's energy is directed into body alone, we are subnormal. In this also, we recognize what is termed the passional power of the soul. Because once it is intoxicated by body, it becomes a tremendous, blind, driving force, which we call ambition. An ambition is a motion. Ambition is a tremendous psychic energy. And this energy drives like a heartless taskmaster. And this energy drive is a phase of the suffering or condition of the deluded soul. The soul, having been captured, having been intoxicated, having lost all vision and perspective, releases its energies in these erratic pressures. And we have all of the different fields of psychoneurotic difficulty and even psychic disease. Because the soul, not being permitted to be what it was intended to be, becomes sick. All energies or powers which are not used according to the laws governing their usage are said to be abused. And if they are abused, they rebel. And ultimately, the wrong use brings the entire compound to dissolution. If, on the other hand, when the soul has attained equilibrium within the body and has brought the body to maturity, according to Plato then, the soul becomes the mistress of the body, becomes its leader, becomes its goddess, is the one to whom, like the mystic troubadours of old, all these love songs of the minstrels were written. The soul becomes the dark lady of the Shakespearean sonnet, becomes the mysterious dark virgin of King Solomon's song. It is this mysterious beloved, sought always by the various Arabic sects, such as the Dervishes and the Sufis and the Druzes and all of these groups. The soul then finds, or should find, the body at its feet, adoring it, and recognizing it as the Virgin Sophia, the great mother of the body, and the great guide and guardian of the body. And the soul, of course, in its own proper nature, is symbolic of the sanctuary, of the ecclesia, the church, the cathedral, the temple, the mosque. All these are soul symbols, symbols of internal sanctuary. The soul, having thus achieved its proper purpose, and presuming, which is not very generally so in these days, that it has reached its equilibrium, having achieved that which is necessary for the body, the soul then verges upward toward union with understanding, or toward union with the rational part of the nature, in so doing, achieving the vitalization and motivation of the inner life of the being. Now, we have to pause for a moment to discover something more about the nature of the soul, because in the Greek and also later in the Neoplatonic mysticism, the soul's position in its own essential nature was very important to this discussion. In the great Platonic triad of the One, the Beautiful, and the Good, the soul is the beautiful because it is motion. And motion, according to the ancients, rhythmic motion, was the most abstract and perfect symbol of beauty. The soul of itself generates from itself nothing dissimilar to itself. The soul as the first of beings, the most perfect of generations, therefore of its own nature, does not generate dissimilars, but is one of those ineffable blossoms suspended from being, which become the source of beauty and of order and of harmony in the world. The great influence of the soul, even upon body, is to bring it to normalcy, to health, to equilibrium, to growth, to manifestation, so that the healthy body is even to the artist the most beautiful of all forms in nature, the most perfect, because it is not only a magnificent unity, but it is also a transcendent beauty. And being beautiful, it is necessary. And being necessary, it is beautiful. Because all beauty flows to the fulfillment of necessity. And that which is absolutely sufficient to its own need is beautiful. This was another rule of beauty. Because that which is sufficient must in all of its parts be related symmetrically, aesthetically, and harmoniously. So we know that the lower power of the soul, when transmuted and transformed, that from what is called the generative or irrational phase of the soul, comes the supreme irrationality.